I'm Walt Bowman, and I teach at Trinity Lutheran Seminary in Columbus, Ohio. We were the first seminary jointly owned by the ALC and the LCA, but we are no longer the only one, and I'm glad for that. We sort of anticipated the merger of our institutions, and I've been at Holden often, and I'm very, very happy to be back. But this is the first time in this space. Let's see, about 3 years ago when we were here, it was under construction. I think it's been used, about 2 years now, and I'm happy to be over here. I'm going to do something on barmen this week, and I'll explain what that is in a moment. But first, I wanted to get in a commercial. I'm selling Lutheran incense, a special blend of the finest selected ingredients, guaranteed absolutely no smoke, no odor. No one will ever know you're using it. And let's see, also no postage is necessary. It doesn't weigh anything, so anybody who wants to buy this can see me later. I brought along some quotations, too, that my son sent to me because he said I needed some new jokes. All the people at Holden had heard my old ones. So here's a quote from Red Fox. Health nuts are going to feel stupid someday, lying in a hospital, dying from nothing. If these work, I'll keep them, all right? So you're the test audience here. These are some bests of 1983. We're a little late, but then I haven't... I just got these last week in San Francisco. Best supermarket sign. Please do not fondle our fruit. Ask for a clerk. These aren't bad. Most unloved person of 1983. Author Calvin Trillin, who hates Halloween so much that he gave the kids who came trick-or-treating Brussels sprouts. Let me see, one more here. Most apt self-description, Andy Warhol. I am a deeply superficial person. All right, well, these work. I'll use them next week again. But I promise no more this week, all right? Barman. I think if we were going to make an assessment of the most significant ecclesiastical events of this century, and I suppose that's almost inevitable now that we're winding down the century with just a few more years to go, we would all probably say at the top of my list at least would be the Second Vatican Council. But I think the most dramatic event of this century probably was the Synod at Barmen in May, that is the 29th to 31st of May, 1934. This is the 50th anniversary year of that Barmen Synod. And I want to say more specifically about the Barmen Synod tomorrow. Sorry about that for all of you that are leaving today. But I'll say a little bit today, at least, so that we can get some idea of what went on. I visited Barmen myself in 1980 because Will Mochan, who was then doubling when he wasn't studying as a cook here at Holden, did an internship in Wuppertal. And Barmen is a suburb or a suburban area of Wuppertal, and there is an evangelical seminary located there. And in 1934, Barmen was the location of a synod of 138 delegates, drafted a confession in opposition to Hitler and to the German Christians, and almost all of those 138 people who attended the synod at Barmen in 1934 paid with prison or exile or death. I think that's what makes it such a dramatic moment. We were a couple of months away at that time from Hitler's purge of his own supporters, which occurred at the end of June, beginning of July 1934. But already people were very aware, or at least many people were very aware, of the ruthless nature of the political powers at that time. And their meeting in 1934 was an act of enormous political courage. I think what I've entitled this week's sessions at 10:45 is The Lessons of Barman. I think that's what we want to be looking at for 5 days. And in order to do that, I've given us five topics. The church as chaplain, first of all, which is really a way of asking how did it happen? How could the whole Hitler phenomenon have happened in the first place? And the church's largely enthusiastic response to Hitler. That's what I want to talk about today. How did it happen? The church as chaplain. Then tomorrow, the church as confessor, the prophetic martyr church. What actually did happen then at Barman? On Wednesday, the church as critic, the whole business of the relationship of the German church to Hitler had significant consequences for the way in which the churches then responded to communism after the Second World War. So I want to look at the church as critic, the church under communist governance, particularly in East Germany, on Wednesday. Then a look at our churches, the churches in the West. I've titled that one The Church as Conspirator. And I should explain that briefly, because the Western democracies are largely the product of the Enlightenment. Certainly, American democracy is more than anything else the product of the Enlightenment, which is not specifically Christian at all. I think it's a mistake for many people, including the moral majoritarians in this country, to want to take us back to the roots of our founding fathers. There weren't any mothers involved, I don't think, but at least they want to take us back to those roots. They would be appalled. The Smithsonian a couple of months ago had a long article on Jefferson's Bible. He would not have made it with the moral majority. He had got his scissors out and excised all kinds of things that Jesse Helms is for. So the question then is, how does the church relate to an Enlightenment culture, which is essentially what we have today? And that's a real problem for us, but my proposal is we got to be in a conspiracy vis-a-vis our Enlightenment roots. And I'll talk about that on Thursday. And then on Friday, the church and the coming kingdom, a vision for the church as the final lesson from Barman. Today, the church has chaplain. In one sense, we have to begin in the middle. I'm not going to go back to the very foundations. Jan and I were on we were with a group of faculty people and clergy from Columbus this summer. I was their theologian for 19 days in Europe, and our German tour director, in typical Teutonic fashion, got up on the first morning in the bus and said that he wanted to get us well anchored in European history. So he started with Heidelberg Man about 5 million years ago, or whenever it was. And I thought, of course, you know, how German. Absolutely, you just can't understand anything about Germany unless you start with Heidelberg Man. Well, please don't be worried. I'm not going to do that this morning. I have more modest expectations. John Shea, in a lovely book called Stories of God, says, well, we've got to begin in the middle because most of us are middle people. And he didn't mean middle-aged either. I think he just meant that our own lives begin in the middle. I have to learn my beginnings from somebody else. My recollection of the story of my own life starts, I don't know, maybe about 9 or 10. I'm 55 now. My son said 13 Celsius. And my friend said anything over 55 is illegal, so I'm waiting for it to be fun again. Starting in the middle, that is somewhere. Maybe what we ought to do is start with Hitler and just work backwards as far as we need to try to understand how it happened. I think it's important for us to start with Hitler. I think other terrible things have happened in this century, and some of them even in our lifetime, the massacre of half the population of Cambodia, just as an example, the dreadful things that Alexander Solzhenitsyn tells us about the gulags. But in one sense or another, Hitler is a kind of symbol for us, certainly for people my age and older. Hitler becomes a symbol. The war against him was one of the purer, one of the conflicts that had perhaps purer motives than most of the others that we've been involved in. Hitler remains a kind of dreadful scar on our century. Among other things, we went to Dachau one Sunday afternoon when we were in Munich this summer. Our guide and our bus driver would not take us there. And that itself is instructive. The people of Dachau would like to change the name. If you ever go to Europe, go to Dachau. The people streamed out there on this Sunday. The trains were full, the buses were jammed, and fortunately, many of the people who went were young people, young American and high school students and students from other countries. I'm glad they went. It is a very instructive visit. That's one of the ways to make us conscious of that period. Auschwitz, another symbol, but it lies in Poland and it's hard to get to. Dachau you can get to. In Dresden we saw a church bombed. Still a ruin. It's going to be left exactly that way as a reminder of what happened to the city of Dresden in February of 1945. You can still see plaques on buildings that have been rebuilt. 238 people perished in the cellar of this building on the night of February, whatever it was, 1945. Those are reminders of the kind of scar that Adolf Hitler is on this century. 26 million people what am I talking about? 46 million people lost their lives as a direct result of the kind of things that Hitler initiated. 12 million of them German. That's an interesting statistic. Hardly any American, which is another thing we ought to ponder. I think maybe something like 250,000 Americans lost their lives in World War II. But many, many Europeans. It remains a scar. The chronology is relatively easy to lay out. Hitler was appointed Chancellor of Germany by the then President, Otto von Hindenburg, who on January 30th, 1933, Hindenburg was brought to this point because of the virtual collapse of the parliamentary system in Germany in those fateful months of the winter of 1932-33. Hitler was not in office a month before a heavily guarded Reichstag building mysteriously caught fire and burned on the night of February 27-28. The reconstruction of those events today, of course, is that the fire was set by some members of the Brown Shirts, four or five, Those who really knew were all massacred in 1934, so there's no way of getting at the full story anymore. At any rate, mentally retarded Dutchman was hauled out as a member of the Communist Party and assigned the guilt for this fire by the Nazis, tried and executed. And the important thing is that this became the occasion for a very interesting series of laws. The first of them was the Reich President's Edict for the Protection of People and State, which Hitler promulgated the very next day, February 28th, and which remained in force in Germany until May 8th, 1945, that is the day of the surrender. The key provision, I'm quoting from Eberhard Bethke's biography of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, reads as follows, paragraph 1 of the Edict of 28 February 1933. Therefore, restriction of personal freedom, of the right of free speech, including the freedom of the press, of the right of association and public assembly, intervention in the privacy of mail, telegraph, and telephone, authorization of search warrants, and confiscation and restriction of property beyond the hitherto legal limits will henceforward be admissible. You know, think about that. Press, individual, free speech, right of association, the ability to search mail, telegraph, telephone, listen in, wiretaps, authorization of search warrants beyond what has hitherto been legally admissible, beyond the hitherto legal limits, is henceforth admissible. You don't need any other laws. I mean, if you got that one, you don't need anything else. I was, just a biographical note, I was, as a high school student, I entered the American Legion Oratorical Contest in Fort Wayne. I lost. I don't want to keep you in suspense. But, I mean, this is the Olympics, right? my topic was, I had a professor at that time, a speech coach, who said, you're going to write on the writ of habeas corpus. He said, it's the foundation of American freedom. He said, the Legionnaires will love it. They didn't, but nevertheless, it was. I mean, they liked flags waving in the sunset and that kind of thing. I worked on the writ of habeas corpus as a high school senior for this American Legion Oratorical Contest, and that professor has earned my undying gratitude for putting me onto that topic, because the writ of habeas corpus means nobody can keep you in jail more than 24 hours without filing legal charges, or your lawyer can force whoever has arrested you to produce your corpus, your body. Now that's really the foundation of, in a sense, of our whole civilization. It's not majority vote, but the attention to the personal liberties of a solitary individual that is, in the last analysis, the cornerstone of our society. And that's what Hitler abolished. Abraham Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus in the territories in rebellion during the Civil War. Interesting act. It's a good... I don't know whether it has ever at any other time been suspended on this continent, but it's worth being attentive to because of the role it plays. At any rate, what Hitler did with this act, promulgated by Hindenburg, that is under Hindenburg's name, but actually drafted by Hitler, was the suspension of that cornerstone of the democratic ideal. And then in quick succession, a whole series of decrees followed. On March 5th, the last election to be held while Hitler was in power, the Nazis garnered 44% of the vote. Not a majority, but a substantial minority, and with the help of the German National Conservative Party, again, largely made up of church people, Hitler was able to form a majority government and to promulgate several other laws. On March 21st, the treachery law was promulgated. Baitke describes it as follows. It was applicable to anyone who, with malice aforethought, spreads or puts out untrue or grossly distorted assertion of a factual nature calculated seriously to impair the welfare of the Reich or of a province of the Reich or of the party governing the Reich. So, in other words, anything you do against the party, the Reich, or a province of the Reich could be regarded as treasonable. I thought about this again and how easily the word treason came to the lips of leaders of this country, you see, whenever their policies were being subject to critique and opposition. Johnson did it, Nixon did it. I mean, you know, very quickly we got opposition to the government being identified with treason. That's what Hitler put into his Treachery Act. Combined with the emergency decree of February 28th, the treachery law imposed restrictions on anyone unwilling to identify his loyalty with the administration of Adolf Hitler. And then the crowning blow on April 1st, the reconstruction of the professional civil service, the so-called Aryan Law, which prohibited any person with Jewish ancestry or married to a person of Jewish ancestry from holding a civil service position in Germany, including pastorates or administrative functions in the churches. It is to the shame of the German churches that they accepted the provisions of the Aryan Law of 1933. Even many of the people who later went to Barmen and laid their own lives and careers on the line went along with the Aryan Law in the Prussian Church, at that time the Prussian United Church. Some 14 clergy lost their positions. We stayed in Eisenach in 1980 in the Werner Zilten House. Zilten was one of the clergy persons in Thuringia who lost his pastorate because he was half Jewish. His father was Jewish. Now, we have to remember there were about 700,000 Jews living in Hitler's Germany at that time, not the largest contingent of Jews in Europe at all. About 300,000 of these 700,000 Jews were Christian. In the 19th century, large numbers of Jews, for a variety of reasons, some good, some bad, converted to Christianity, including Felix Mendelssohn's father and family. His grandfather, Moses Mendelssohn, was a leading Jewish scholar, but his son and Mendelssohn's father became a Christian. Mendelssohn himself was a Christian. So there were, one could name hundreds of prominent people in 19th century Germany who had Jewish ancestry but who became Christians. Many of these people found careers in the church, had pastorates, were leading people in the churches. I did my doctorate on the confessional Lutheran movement of the 19th century at Heidelberg, and about a third of the people that I wrote about 14 people who were leaders of the confessional revival. And about a third of them had Jewish ancestry. So there was a large Jewish Christian group of people in Germany at that time. The church abandoned these people, quite literally. Just let them be a prey to Hitler, except for a small group known as the Bureau Grieber, some 90 evangelicals who set up a movement known as Evangelische Hilfstelle für Rasseverfolgte, the evangelical first aid station, literally, for the people who were being racially persecuted. The Bureau Grieber did not survive. The Gestapo penetrated it and in 1941 arrested every last person. More than two-thirds of them perished in concentration camps, and not a one of them escaped without some time in prison. The church response to all of this was mixed but largely positive to Hitler. And it's astonishing to read things today that were written in America by clergymen in America, published in 1934 or 35, describing the German church struggle. I looked up a few of these things in our seminary library when I gave some lectures on the Barman event in May, and American churchmen from a broad range of denominations all had a positive evaluation of Hitler and a negative evaluation of this small group of troublemakers in the Confessing Church who were not committed to the renewal of Germany. That's the way it was put. The renewal of Germany was proceeding apace. Hitler had cleared out bread lines. Hitler was opposed to homosexuals. Hitler was opposed to, he was in favor of the family, all the values of society and civilization. And here you had this small group of troublemakers opposed to the renewal of Germany. Most of the Germans belonged to one of two groups of churches, either the German Christians, Deutsche Christen, who were enthusiastically Nazi, one Volk, one Reich, one Führer, one Church, were the slogans. And in 1980, when I was in Germany, Lutz Mohaupt, who's now the head pastor of the Church of Hamburg, just shared with us copies of speeches that were made by church officials. You read them today, 50 years later, and you're just appalled that people could have said those things. But they were enthusiastic, flag-waving, pro-Nazi statements. That was the German Christians. Headquartered where? The Lutherlands, Thuringia, Saxony, and then Bremen, Hamburg, and Oldenburg, those places. My ancestors come from this part of Germany. They're Ostfriesen. The Germans don't tell Polish jokes, they tell Ostfries jokes, like the Ostfriesen who practiced for his visit to England by driving on the left side of the road. But those were the main places where the Deutsche Christen were very strong, where they had church elections and just swept everything. Then there were the so-called intact churches. Again, these were largely Lutheran, Württemberg, southern Germany, Bavaria, where a sort of concordat, Hanover was another one of these intact churches, sort of concordat was made with the German government. We won't do anything about politics, you don't do anything about church affairs. In the end, these so-called intact churches provided significant cadres of leadership against Hitler. People like Hans Lilje, coming from Hanover, and Theophil Wurm, who was the Bishop of Württemberg, and Hans Meiser, the Bishop of Bavaria. Good people, but in those early years they wanted to keep their churches intact, that is, untouched by the Deutsche Christen. They succeeded, but at a terrible price. And,
they still had to dismiss their Jewish pastors.
Yes, they did, but everybody was doing that. I mean, Karl Barth went along with that initially, and so did the Confessing Church people. Bonhoeffer was one of the few voices raised in opposition to the dismissal of Jewish pastors. Everybody did it. There was a third group of churches, Prussia and Berlin with its Berlin-Brandenburg, and the Rhineland were the centers of this, Hesse, the Rhineland, and Berlin-Brandenburg, where a bitter struggle began to take place between the so-called Confessing Church, Bekennende Kirche, and the pro-Nazi faction in the church. And it was from these churches, together with some of the Lutheran churches, that the delegates of Barman came. But we still haven't answered the question, how? How could it happen? How could Hitler get the churches to do this? And I think to answer that question, I want to say just a few words about establishment in Europe. We could start with Constantine, whose Edict of Toleration in 312 and whose establishing of the Christian Church caused the problems ultimately. But I want to start instead with the Reformation. In 1520, Martin Luther wrote a treatise, one of the three great 1520 treatises, called An Address to the German Nobility. Impatient with the capacity of the bishops to respond to the reform of the church, Luther finally said, the leading lay people, the leading laymen, they were all men, should be, by virtue of their baptism, take over the reform of the church. The leading laymen were the dukes, princes, margraves, and so on, and they were happy to do so. Sometimes because they were deeply pious and really believed the Reformation, and sometimes because by confiscating church lands, at that time about a third of the territory in Europe, they could provide a new source of revenue for their governments. Was it piety? Was it politics? Was it greed? Yes. Probably a combination of all three. But at any rate, it did not take long for the leading lay people to become the leaders of reform. By 1530, at Augsburg, at the Diet, these lay people handed in the Augsburg Confession. Remember, it was essentially a political document, not a church confession. The Augsburg Confession was a way of justifying the reforms which the princes and town councils had introduced in their territories. What happened as a result of this was that the churches became a department of the state in a very clear way. Obviously, a prince was not going to run the church himself. What he did do was appoint a superintendent who would, in his name, administer the church. This happened in Germany because the bishops, almost to the last person, did not accept the reforms, whereas the people, the clergy, and the princes and the town councils did. In Scandinavia, the bishops went along with the reforms, but they were still somehow subservient to the political powers. That's part of the problem in Sweden today, where some of the people want to disestablish the church because they don't like the ordination of women, decreed by parliament and made law in the churches. You still have parliaments deciding what's going to happen in the churches. In England, the queen appoints the bishops. She does so with consultation, but she makes the appointments. They are her ministers just as surely as the prime minister is her minister. That happened in Germany too, that the leading powers in the state, the political powers, appointed the superintendents and through them ran the churches. You can see a symbol of this if you go to Coburg. There in the castle, you can see the layout of the furniture, and it says everything. High up over the second floor is a balcony. You go directly from the ducal apartments to this balcony in the chapel where you can worship. The pulpit is about 5 feet lower than the balcony and about 20 feet higher than the pews. The highest instance in that building is the ducal family. Between them and the people in the pews is the pulpit, lower than the by 5 feet than the duke, but higher by 20 feet than the people. That says it all, you see. The clergy and the churches are the ways in which the dukes did two things: provided religious services for the people and made sure that the voice of religion would always be on the side of established authority. The voice of religion would be protective of law and order. The religion thus became a way in which a prince cared for his people, just as roads were, highways, or police protection. So you also provided for people's religious needs. That had enormous consequences for the immigrants who came to America. Because they were no longer citizens of the countries from which they emigrated, the churches and the princes of those countries no longer felt any obligation to provide them with religious services. The result is that they either went without or got those religious services by appealing to independent societies back in the old country until they could establish their own seminaries. There's a letter from a fellow by the name of Frederick Wieneken, back to Wilhelm Lea in Neuendettelsau in Germany, saying, "Send us clergy to save these good Germans from the Methodists and other rotten Sekten, other rotters and sects." Strange stuff, you know. So one consequence was that once you emigrated, the prince back there in Mecklenburg or wherever could just wash his hands of you. The other consequence was for the mission of the church. Since religion was largely the prince's concern for his people, the territorial churches of Germany and of Scandinavia did not engage in any mission work abroad in the Third World. That was left to private societies like the Basel Missionary Society or the Leipzig Missionary Society or the Hermannsburg Missionary Society or whatever. There must have been some Scandinavian ones too, but I don't know that history very well. At any rate, those missionary societies were the ones that did overseas work, because the churches never did that. To this day, the German, Lutheran, and Protestant churches do not directly engage in overseas mission work. To this day. It's strange. Impossible for us to think, but that's the consequence. Now, what does it mean then to describe the church's chaplain? A chaplain is one who provides religious services for people unable to engage in those religious activities themselves, unable for a variety of reasons. The main one was you did not have the legal right, if you were not a chaplain, you did not have the legal right to marry, to baptize, to perform the burial services, to give instruction in religion. You could read a sermon if you were a lay person, but you couldn't write your own. Somebody else had to write it for you. That was the chaplain's function. He provided religious services that you were either incompetent or unable to provide. The church as chaplain served the princes and, as I said earlier, became a strong bulwark for established authority in every way. In the 19th century, this had fateful consequences. And there, the alliance of throne and altar, throne and altar, opposed all of the revolutionary impulses that were let loose in society at that time. You probably all know that the Germans are the largest single ethnic group in the American mix, something like 27%. Of the current population of the U.S. of A. is German in origin. Why isn't the Lutheran Church any bigger then, or the Catholic Church for that matter, especially since we can add the Scandinavians to Lutheranism too? It's because large numbers of the people who came to this country, the Germans, especially after the revolutions of 1830 and 1848, were anti-clerical. When the Missouri Synod people landed in Missouri, the German newspaper, Anzeiger des Westens, had bitter, bitter comments about these religious nuts who were coming over, and they didn't want to have anything to do with them. That's part of the reason why the Missouri people then left St. Louis and went to Perry County, a very inhospitable place, and tried to settle there. Above all, the church, because you have to understand, this was the time of the Industrial Revolution. This was the time of a lot of problems happening for workers. What happened was that the workers who were involved in seeking greater political freedom were opposed not only by the princes, but by the alliance of throne and altar, by the clergy who were quite conservative in their orientation. That was one of the things I discovered, again, when I did my doctoral work, that the confessional movement of the 19th century was conservative not only in its religious outlook, but also in its political outlook. Religiously, it meant the restoration of confessional Lutheranism. I guess I affirm that, I really do. But politically, it meant the alienation of the vast mass of the working classes from the churches, so that to this day in Germany, the churches are largely churches of the middle class, not the working class. When you hear horror stories about empty churches, they are largely going to be told about working class areas in the large industrial parts of the country. If you go to middle class sections, you're going to find pretty good church attendance. If you go to the rural areas, you're going to find pretty good church attendance too. It's the working class that has been alienated. You want to get it all? The consequence of this was that the socialist and communist parties just emerging about this same time were anti-establishment and anti-clerical. And now you get so-called Christian political parties that represent the conservative end of the political spectrum, where the term Christian becomes part of the party's name, you see. It was divided before World War II largely into Catholic, the Catholic Center Party, which was a conservative party, and the German National Conservative Party, which was the Protestant version of this. After World War II, that became the Christian Democratic Party, Catholic and Protestant. And the socialists were regarded as, you know, inimical to the interests of the church, much more so the communists. That was a very fateful move in the 19th century for the churches politically. Officially, they were not to be political. They were to be, in Ernst Troeltsch's phrase, all-encompassing. That is to say, if you're going to be the chaplain to society, you don't take a political position. But in practice, see, they did take a political position, even if it meant saying nothing, so that they ended up on the side of the status quo. They saw that their own interests, the church's own interests, lay largely on the side of political conservatism. First the princes, then whoever was in power was to protect the church. Hitler made a promise to restore to the churches the privileges which it had lost in 1918. And that's part of the reason why the churches ended up being fairly enthusiastic about Hitler at the beginning. They feared socialism and communism. Hitler was against that. They wanted the restoration of their privileges. Hitler promised that. They wanted the restoration of German national honor. Hitler seemed to be about to bring that back. So they ended up on the side of Hitler. What kind of theological vision lay behind this? A couple of points. They regarded religion basically as a separate sphere. You see, it's familial, it's private, it doesn't have anything to do with the public sphere. They regarded it as otherworldly. Religion is the way you get people from this life to the world to come. Therefore, we don't have to get involved in all the things that are happening in this world. If the government says dismiss Jewish pastors, well, you know, we'll do that, because basically we're about getting people into heaven when they die. Is this a betrayal? I want to stop there with a quote from Daniel Berrigan in an article entitled On Getting Nowhere, Standing By, Notes on Being Marginal. He says, the margin is the space created, the space along the edge where the text is absent, but it is also the space created by the text itself. Please note the irony here. The text of Scripture is commonly thought of as written about winners, but the text is in fact written about losers. More, it is written by a loser, also named friend, advocate, Messiah. This may be true, but then something else, something shocking, an astonishing larceny occurs. The text is rather quickly snatched or appropriated by the winners. It is thereby violently uprooted from its proper hands, its sources, its geography, its setting. It belonged in a hut, a knapsack, a beggar's hand. It was written to illuminate not merely what happens in the world, but the meaning of that world, its events, its eons, its cataclysms, its pretensions and ironies and futilities, all this from the special point of view of the no account, the remnant. Now the text is in other hands. It is captive, colonized, bowdlerized. It has been taken from the edge, the margin of life where it was written, about which scene and folk it was written, to the dead center. Now it is another inert form of property, a dead letter, a hieroglyph. That's an interesting commentary, it seems to me, on the church that becomes chaplain. Because when it becomes chaplain, it really falls prey to forces that may, in the last analysis, be alien to its own identity and its own meaning. And then a demonic power like Hitler's can seize it. In 1933, Hitler appointed a Reichsbischof. He wanted control of the church as he had control over everything else, and the churches worked to give Hitler that kind of control. That is, they just sort of let it happen. But that was in continuity with all of the other sort of power plays that had been visited upon the church from Luther's time onward. Well, we've got about 14 minutes that we can use to talk about this. How do you react to that dimension of our history? Back there, start.
What were some of the privileges that were taken away from the German church in 1918? You mentioned that Hitler promised restoration of some of those, and that's one of the reasons that the church capitulated. Can you refresh?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think the privileges would be largely symbolic. What happened in 1918 was that the churches were officially disestablished. But the disestablishment was of an interesting sort. The state agreed to continue collecting the taxes by which the church was supported, and the churches then ceased to be departments of the state. They retained the right to give instruction in the public schools. It's from 1918 on that in Germany, at least, the leaders are no longer called superintendents but bishops. So they took the title bishop back, Landesbischof, and they continued to administer a lot of the welfare, social welfare in Germany. But the act of disestablishment was a symbolic act, which the churches, in a sense, felt deeply as a loss of moral and influential clout. And Hitler used language like the churches would receive once again the influence over individual and family which was their due. That was the kind of language that Hitler was using, and the churches saw this as a promise to reestablish them. Hitler, in the end, meant no such thing. Hitler, by the way, although he was baptized, was not a practicing Christian, nor were most of the people in his coterie. An incident that I want to say more about tomorrow, when he assembled his parliament on the 21st of March, after that March 5 election, while the Protestants all went into the garrison church at Potsdam for a service, Hitler and Goebbels went to the graves of party heroes there to engage in their own religious act. But they did not attend the Protestant service, nor did they attend the Catholic service. But Hitler promised them, and this was his language, a restoration of the influence which was their due. Now there's the hooker, you see. Who was going to determine what was the church's due influence? The churches read that in terms of maximum restoration to the position that they had held prior to 1918. Hitler meant they were going to be tame pets on a leash that he established. And that's, in effect, what he did with the Reichsbischof and with the Ministry of Religious Affairs. But it took some time for all of that to come out. I think, as I said, I think the privilege that they were captivated by was a symbolic one. In effect, the churches still occupy a privileged position in Germany to this day, Scandinavia too.
It wasn't in any sense a theological kind of issue, certainly not for Hitler, but I don't hear that the churches perceived it in any of that kind of milieu either. It was strictly a very practical, political kind of...
Yes.
Well, I don't want to use the word ministry, but carrying out of the practical functions that the church had enjoyed prior to that, which was more of a social...
Yes. Oh, I can give one concrete instance of a privilege that the church lost in 1918, namely the sole and exclusive right to authorize the contracting of marriages. From 1918 on, marriage became a civil affair. To this day, you go first of all to the Standesamt, Bureau of Vital Statistics, where the real legal marriage takes place. And then if you want, you may also go to the church for a blessing. In 1918, the church lost the right to be the sole and exclusive agency through which marriages could be contracted.
Why did this happen in 1918? Was this, 1918 was the end of the war, but what happened that made this upheaval in the form of government?
All hereditary rulers were removed in 1918. The Kaiser, but not only the Kaiser, everybody. The Wittelsbachs lost their thrones in Bavaria. The Hessian royal house lost its ruling authority. They also lost property that was royal or ducal or whatever. Now, with that were abolished also the departments of government, and you had in Germany's national life the Weimar Constitution, and in the states similar kinds of constitutions, so that the church was technically disestablished because it was no longer a department of religious affairs of the local prince. Now, in places where the rulers were much loved, as Hesse, for example, they retained significant influence, but there is still a Hessian royal family. I may tell you about this on Thursday, I think, when I'm going to talk about it, but I spent a day in Hesse in November of this past year. I was invited to give a lecture on Luther's birthday in Darmstadt, and the next day I was received by the socialist mayor of Darmstadt, who said, Reagan is the new Hitler. We went right from there to lunch with the Princess of Hesse, who said, oh, your Mr. Reagan is a wonderful man. You must keep him, you Americans. She's English and comes from the English royal house, but she's lived in Hesse since 1937. And the Hessian royal family had close ties with the English royal family, so that they got a lot of relief and welfare through the Hessian royal family after both world wars from England. And the Hessian royal family was very much loved by the Hessians, not by anybody else. Mm-hmm. And so they still retain a castle outside the city and burial rites in the city church and all that kind of stuff. But the church was disestablished along with the royal houses as a result of the surrender in 1918.
When you refer to the church, I'm assuming that you're referring at that time that the voice of the church was the clergy.
Yes.
Was there a dissension at all by the laity? And if there was, did that group stay in the church or did they move outside of the church? Did they leave the church?
That's an interesting question. In the Reformation, the dissent was focused largely in the Anabaptist groups. These groups were persecuted by Catholic and Protestant reformers alike. They suffered terribly. Many of them emigrated. And so there has never been a sizable non-establishment group in Germany. There's a small Mennonite church in Germany. I met with some of the leaders of that church in 1980 when I was there because they were trying to have the Lutheran World Federation repudiate some of the anti-Mennonite stuff in the Augsburg Confession. There's a small Methodist church, a small Baptist church. These are all lay-oriented, but they're very small and play virtually no role in German public life. Pietism was an attempt to get lay renewal in the churches, and often there were Pietist conventicles that met without a pastor being present. But this was very much discouraged and eventually became very well integrated into the churches. In Scandinavia, the Pietist movement again ended up, it was severely opposed by the official church, and the lay leader or the lay responsibility dimension of Pietism ended up emigrating to this country, or at least large chunks of it did. I think it's quite correct to say that church was the clergy and the administration and the leadership. They did the talking, they did the marrying, they did the burying, they did the baptizing, they did everything. But stop and think for a moment. To this day, in this country, whenever we say, what is the voice of the church on any issue, we don't mean, let's take a poll of all the members. We mean, what are the clergy saying, or what are the bishops saying?
In the situation I was referring to, the political, were there people, I don't want to say the intelligentsia, I guess, of the church who were lay, who would say, clergy, this is a political thing, we have to respond to it. I mean, that's where the Barman Synod came from almost, and that was all clergy. Mm-hmm. Almost. Was there any lay involved? I mean, it's hard for me to think that the lady sat back and didn't question anything, but it's possible that,
yeah. Yeah, there was lay involvement. Just a little incident involving Will Mochan again. I was there with Will on a weekend, and we went to church on Sunday morning. And after church, they had a reception. And I talked to some of the lay leaders of the congregation where Will was interning. And one elderly woman, just with tears, said, all the things that we thought we had learned out of the church struggle are just disappearing again, and we're becoming a clerical church once more. My teacher, Edmund Schlink, who died just this past May, once said in a moving account to me of his own, see, he was dismissed from his professorship twice, first from university, then from Bethel, from the theological seminary, which was closed, and he ended up being a kind of circuit rider among these confessing congregations. And he said, the gifts of lay leadership that the Holy Spirit gave us in those years, that was the biggest fruit of Barman and the confessing church. But it very quickly in the West again became a clericalized operation. In contrast to East Germany, which I'm going to talk about on Thursday or Wednesday. This mayor of Darmstadt, father, was a lawyer, a lay lawyer for a lot of these confessing church pastors. And it was a kind of wonderful time in Germany. But it didn't last. And the lay leadership gift just sort of sprang almost out of nothing. But they were not really there. The church was heavily clericalized.
It was an entire society.
Yeah.
It splits between the class system.
Exactly. One of the things that struck me while I was a student in Germany and going back now to West Germany is the class nature of this, because the clergy belonged to the educated class. And they shared Bildung, education, with the nobility and with the other professions. And they ran the society, and the clergy ran the religious part of it. But it was establishment to the core. Dan.
Yeah, there might not be time to discuss this, but I'd be interested in reflections on, does the American church serve a chaplain role?
We are going to get to that on Thursday. In fact, we can talk about it all week long. I hope you noticed that those kinds of questions were not far from anything that I said this morning.
Right. I was hoping we could, you'd bring us up to date.
We got to do a little bit of history, but we're going to be in that. Are you going
to
be around this week?
Before we get to the frosting, huh?
Well,
we almost did a Wednesday, so put a little bit in there.
All right, tomorrow, we can talk about it tomorrow. Certainly we'll have to. And Wednesday, when we talk about the church in East Germany under communism as a consequence of Barman. Well, thank you. I look forward to this week. It'll be wonderful.